Welcome to Public Historians at Work, a podcast series from the Center for Public History at the University of Houston. I'm Dr. Monica Perales, Associate Professor of History and Director of CPH. In this podcast series, we speak with academics, artists, activists, and community members about what it means to do history and humanities work for and with the public. In our second season, we're examining public history as it relates to medicine, health, and the well-being of our global community. For more resources on these topics and ways to support the mission of CPH, make sure to check us out at uh.edu/class/CPH or find us on Facebook and Twitter at UHCPHistory. Together, we can help reclaim our past.
With debates about healthcare dominating the news, the past resonates all the more. American historian Dr. Ronit Stahl clearly illustrates this principle in her conversation with Dr. Mark Goldberg on February 11, 2022. Whether understanding the 2014 Hobby Lobby ruling about the birth control insurance mandate, the claim of religious hospitals to conscience rights and public funds, or the Trump administration's ban on transgender troops, Dr. Stahl reveals how history can help us ask better questions about the present. This is no mere academic exercise, but one of service to the wider public, as Dr. Stahl demonstrates through her many meetings with community groups and military organizations, numerous op-eds, and even a 2018 amicus brief before the U.S. Court of Appeals. Let's listen in.
Welcome, Dr. Ronit Stahl. Thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about a variety of things today, but the first thing I'd like to do is to start by talking about your current research project. And if you can tell us, how did you come to medical history and specifically your research on religious hospitals?
You know, this is a fun question for me because I didn't start as a historian of medicine, but made my way over to the history of healthcare in the United States through, I suppose, either a winding or linear path, depending on how it's framed. So, you know, I started and am a historian of religion and the state, religion, law, and politics in the modern United States. And my current work on religious hospitals comes in part out of my interest in religion and the state, in part out of what I've come to realize is a love of the stories institutions tell us. I think often people think of institutions as kind of boring, but I actually find them fascinating, and thinking about how they work and what they reveal about society writ large. But most directly, my current project on religious hospitals really came out of the Hobby Lobby decision in 2014. So as folks may recall, in 2014, the Supreme Court decided that Hobby Lobby, as a closely held for-profit corporation, could reject part of the contraceptive mandate of the Affordable Care Act. And the decision was handed down in June, which was a couple months after I finished my dissertation on the military chaplaincy. And you might quite reasonably wonder what the connection there is. But in the commentary about the decision, a lot of people started talking about Hobby Lobby through the framework of conscience and conscientious objection. And one of the things that really annoyed me about this conversation was that it would often make analogies to the military that were wrong. So, like, I had actually spent a fair amount of time studying conscientious objection in the military and how it worked, particularly on a very practical level. What happened when you conscientiously object? How had law thought about conscientious objection in this context? And that really got me into that space of thinking about, like, what happens when people make arguments, especially in the public sphere, that attempt to analogize situations or institutions that historically have actually operated on very different tracks. Now, intellectually, it can be really fun and exciting to make these analogies and to think through where comparisons work or don't. But what I was seeing was comparisons being asserted that weren't grounded in a reality. So that got me into thinking about conscience in healthcare and what did it look like? And, you know, originally I started thinking about individuals, which is, of course, when people object to the draft, it was individual objectors. So, you know, it's interesting to think about what does this look like on an individual level. But the more I got into the history, the more I realized that hospitals as institutions matter, and they matter because, in part, hospitals acquired conscience rights in 1973. And so if we think about institutions, and hospitals are not just institutions, but they are corporations. They can be for-profit or nonprofit. There are different kinds of corporations, but corporate conscience rights can date to the early 70s. So that first got me into this institution. And I was reading in the history, the legislative history of this space, and what I then thought was a late 20th century project ended up taking me back to the mid-19th century. So it was also a process of digging deeper and deeper to see a longer and longer history that involved multiple hospitals, different kinds of religions, different kinds of spaces, and trying to think through, what then does the history of religious hospitals tell us about healthcare, about institutions, about religion, about the interaction between religion and law, and about how it was that lots of kinds of corporations were then acquiring conscience rights by the 21st century.
There are two things that really jumped out from what you said when I think about historical research and the historian's craft and public history work. One is the unexpected directions that historical research can take a scholar to. The other is, in the case of your current research, a current event essentially is what really sparked it. Now, a current event sparking a research project doesn't necessarily need to lead to public-facing work, but it does appear that in your career, it has, as you've done quite a bit of public-facing work. And throughout the podcast, we'll talk about, you know, these specific examples. But can you first talk about how you became interested in doing this public-facing work? And also, in addition to the way that your research kind of germinated with this major 2014 event, if you could talk about how public history connects with your research.
Absolutely. One of the attractions of history in the first place was that there is a public element to history, which is to say everyone's engaging in some kind of historical thought at some moment. And I don't just mean in like a high school history class. One of the things before I went to graduate school, one of the reasons I ended up going to graduate school to do a PhD in history was that I found myself reading a lot of history, like for fun, right? I was out of college, I was working, and what did I gravitate toward reading? I loved reading history. Some of it was stuff that I think professional historians would classify as academic scholarship or monographs. Some of it was public history by historians. Some of it was kind of narrative nonfiction history by journalists. But that's what I like to read. What I want to produce, at least in part, is stuff that people could read. And I think one of the things that's exciting about history is that the work of history in many ways is what I like to think of as detective work. Like in the best moments, sitting alone in my office or my house, like working on stuff, I do get to feel like a detective, putting pieces of evidence together, and then writing in a way that both contributes to a deeper understanding of historical scholarship, but done in a way that people can access, that people can read about, either because they're interested, right? It's something like that piques their interest, or because it's relevant to other kinds of work that they are doing, you know, or it might be relevant for policy or law, but that it can be done in a way that's accessible, that's fun, that's engaging. I think for me, another kind of theme of my scholarly work is that I've been fascinated by the interaction of religion and the state in unexpected places, or rather actually hiding in plain sight. You know, the most common reaction to my first project, which started as my dissertation and then became my book, which was about the military chaplaincy, was, huh, I just never thought about that before. And for me, that was a fun challenge. How do you take something that was an institution that I thought could tell us a lot about the United States, a lot about our own history and society? And it was fun to take something that a lot of people actually had some connection to and then say, let's take a look at this. Let's go deeper. So I guess for me, just at core, I'm excited about kind of doing that background work and then producing it in a way that makes it legible, accessible, and hopefully even pleasurable for a broader audience.
So can I follow up on a point you just made about the response to your research on the military chaplaincy? I think always in the classroom or in a public-facing space, people bring preconceived notions about what certain histories are, and that clearly played out when they responded to you by saying, oh, I hadn't thought about this in this way before. And when you're dealing with the military and religion, those are two institutions and also histories that people certainly have preconceived notions about. So can you talk a little bit about the response? Because you're certainly asking people to push against their preconceived ideas. So what has the response been?
What a fun question. So I guess first to be clear, you know, the book goes from World War I to the 90s and like dips a little bit in the epilogue to the present. And for different people, it kind of tapped into both their own knowledge and their own potentially preconceived notions in different ways. For some folks, it was about the tales their maybe a grandfather or an uncle or a parent told them. And then with the more recent past, it was often about people's own experiences or something they saw through family or through friends. So one element is just their own personal knowledge. And, you know, as historians, we're often working with people's individual personal stories in letters or in journals, but we're situating that in a broader context because everyone can have their own personal experience that may or may not be an accurate reflection of an institution or a phenomenon writ large. So, you know, one thing is always kind of just that relationship between the personal or the private and the larger or more public part of how things work. But also this was about, because it was about religion and the military, you know, a lot of people, you know, I think there are one of two directions that went in terms of preconceived notions. One was for some people an initial instinct if they were thinking about the Constitution and the First Amendment was like, wait, how could that be? Like, wait, that is really weird. Why do we have religion in the military? Doesn't the First Amendment, what, how does that work? So sometimes that was a normative claim, like, how could that be? That's wrong. Sometimes that was a curiosity question, right? Like, wait, that doesn't sound right to me. How do you explain it? And then for other people, it was less a normative instinct, but was sort of like what it should look like, right? Like we have some people, there are people in the United States that argue this is a Christian country. So they thought it should look like a Christian phenomenon. There are other people who are like, I write a lot about non-Christian religions in the military. So, you know, what did that mean? Especially if people had some notion about kind of fitting in or acceptance or inclusion, exclusion. You know, one just like fact is that you don't get a Muslim chaplain until the 1990s. And for some people, that's like a good move. For some people, they're like, I don't know. What does that mean? For some people, just like, why is it that long? When you think about them, like they become or can become good and interesting questions. And I think that's part of what's fun is that, you know, whether in a classroom or in a public space is like, you can take wherever people start, right? Like you're meeting them where they are. So whether it's a preconceived notion that's accurate or inaccurate, it's a starting place. It's a way to engage. And I think the goal is to just move from that place to what can I tell you about this that deepens your knowledge, that makes you think about it differently, that maybe makes you want to investigate something more. I think all of those are good outcomes. And it really starts with meeting people where they are. So a reaction that's like, wait, what are you even talking about is great from my perspective, because you get to say like, cool, let me tell you a little more. Let's see what happens.
Did you ever get people respond to your work or your presentations by saying even, or, you know, in some way articulating, I feel seen by your research? Because you did just mention like a big part of your research is covering religious exclusions in the military. And so that this is a representation issue. Did that ever happen? And is there something about that conversation in the public space that for you as a historian felt different than an academic space?
Yes, So one of the most gratifying reactions to my book was emails I got from chaplains telling me like where it resonated with their own experiences. And that was gratifying in part because I had done some interviews, but the vast majority of the book came out of archival materials. And I honestly didn't know how folks in the military would react. I mean, on the one hand, I did know, I did a little bit of research at Fort Jackson, where the chaplain schools are actually now all Army, Navy, Air Force chaplain schools are all now co-located there. I was looking at some Navy materials there. And it was kind of fun. Chaplains would kind of come in. They heard, right? I was there. They'd come in and they'd tell me stories kind of unofficially. Like I wasn't doing formal interviews, but it was fun to talk to them. And they were certainly excited that someone was writing about like, you know, what they did, which is not something that in the broad corpus of either military history or writing about the military is necessarily something that gets a lot of attention. So I think it was like fun for a lot of them to hear that I was working on this project. But, you know, then I was writing and putting this out in the world and having no idea what people would do with it. So it was really delightful to get all sorts of different kinds of emails from chaplains who had served in Vietnam to ones who are serving right now, who were saying like, effectively, like, thank you for capturing something I experienced or went through. And sometimes they would add a story, you know, like you said this in this chapter, and that reminds me of this time when I had a certain experience. Every so often they would push around the edges, but no one, you know, no one was like, you're wrong. Instead, it very much was you've shown the world really something that tells them about my experience and some of the challenges I've faced or processes I've gone through. That was really, really fun. And it's not to say people can't quibble with a book. And, you know, I think pushback is totally fine. But it was exciting that chaplains could see themselves in the book and that it resonated. That's really exciting. I think you put work in the world and to have it resonate feels good. And I do think that's one element that's a little bit different than academic scholarship or, you know, presenting at a conference or just talking kind of in professional circles where what you hope resonates in those places are like, you know, you want an argument to shift how people think. And, you know, the biggest thing for me as a 20th century U.S. historian is getting people to think about religion and getting people to think about religion beyond the right and the left, or like conservative religion and progressive religion. When I started grad school in 2007, it was a moment at which there was a lot of scholarship coming out about the rise of the evangelical right. It was followed by a little bit of scholarship on the progressive left. But I was still really trying to make the case that we need to see religion interwoven into American society. It's not just about its impact on partisan politics. It's about how it structures American life. And that this is a significant part of how people engage with or think about their both their daily lives and the institutions that they interact with in both good and frustrating ways. So in that sense, the intervention is really different. Like it was exciting to write something that could resonate with people who were connected in some way to the chaplaincy or the military, but academically the goals were different. And at the same time, I think the best historical scholarship can do this. You can have an argument that is pushing historical scholarship forward, pushing our understandings at a scholarly level of what the American past looks like. We can do that, but we can also write it in ways that are accessible, that give other people a window into a more complicated past than they might themselves understand. And the final thing I'll say is one of the things that was really important to me in writing the book was that it was interweaving all sorts of different peoples from different religious backgrounds, experiences. So as you said, right, it's very much a history that's about inclusion and exclusion and how these are happening at different moments, what prompts it. And what it meant though, is I had several people at various times, I'd like give a talk to a specific religious community, like a Jewish community talk, or I gave a talk at the Mormon Church History Library. Those were really fun to do. Several times people said to me, oh, you know, in preparing for this, there wasn't like the Jewish chaplains chapter or the LDS chaplains chapter. It's like, because they would ask like, oh, which chapter should I read? I was like, well, you kind of have to read the whole thing. I mean, or pick your part of it, but like, there's not the like, it's not singled out. For me, that was a scholarly commitment because it was meaningful to interweave these experiences. What it also meant from a public perspective was that people who read it would encounter the experiences, the histories of religious groups that they might not otherwise like gravitate to or be interested in reading. And I think that's kind of cool that like by just weaving and braiding a story together, you get people to see a bigger picture than they might have otherwise seen.
It's amazing that you essentially simultaneously created these and had these parallel conversations, but you also were linking them. And yeah, that's an ideal thing to do, you know, and it's hard to do.
It's hard. It's also really fun.
One other major public-facing work that came out of this research from your first book was the amicus brief that you co-authored in a case against the Trump administration, which involved numerous scholars and also the Organization of American Historians, so a major history association, around the issue of discrimination in the military. How did you get involved in the case? And also, what was the process like? I mean, what was it like to be involved in the case?
This all started when my co-author, Jennifer Mittelstadt, and I wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post when the Trump administration had announced that they were going to ban transgender troops. And basically, briefly, under the late Obama administration, transgender troops had been allowed to serve openly. And then suddenly this was being retracted. And so we actually wrote this just as people who had written about the written books on the institution of the military and had paid attention to different forms of discrimination. And again, these kind of patterns of exclusion and inclusion. And we're like, whoa, like this is actually, right, this is big for this current moment. But also this goes against actually a long history in which exclusion is followed by inclusion. And not only that, but once a formerly excluded group has been included, the typical route in the military was then they became essential to military effectiveness, readiness, all the same reasons, all the same rationales that had been proffered as reasons to exclude the group became reasons to include the group later. So we kind of very briefly documented this. We wrote the op-ed just because we thought we had something to say. And I do think, you know, as a larger matter, historians often have something to say about current events that we can provide some background to. And that's what we were originally doing. You know, we had a stance, the Trump administration's move was wrong in our view, but we were saying not just as like citizens, we think this is wrong, but also as historians, this goes against a very long history that we want to remind people, like the military has, you know, previously discriminated against African Americans and then did work to include them, women, immigrants, gay and lesbian soldiers. So we wrote this and that's what we thought we were doing. We thought we were writing an op-ed, which we did. This was then going to be litigated. And lawyers got in touch with us asking us if we would be willing to write an amicus brief. I would say over the past couple of decades, I think historians have been asked more often to write them. I think the way in which it happens probably varies. Sometimes the historians kind of gather and write. Sometimes lawyers approach historians. So I think there's probably different ways in which that emerges. It was fascinating, though, to write in this very different genre. So, you know, we started talking to the lawyers. We were on these like conference calls and we're sort of waiting for the, you know, there are real stages to litigation. And so we're kind of waiting for the moment. We know this is probably going to happen, but we're, you know, they're kind of waiting to figure things out. There's a lot, you know, of strategy in litigation, who else is writing amicus briefs. And, you know, one thing I learned, I just hadn't fully realized because it's not my world. The lawyers representing transgender folks, they, you know, wanted us to write this, but we actually had to have our own attorneys who in this sort of case work pro bono to represent us and file it. So, right, there's a lot of sort of background things that have to happen to let this go through. And then finally in the fall of 2018, they were like, all right, let's go. So we're like, they're like, you know, this is due the end of October. So I think we had like 6 or 7 weeks to really get it together. So it was the two of us drafting it. And again, drafting in just a different register, a different genre. It's like writing for the court, writing for judges. You know, we did a first draft and then we had a conference call again with the lawyers. We're like, all right, well, this is all very interesting, but we've got to get this like streamlined. You've got to make your point way like quicker and faster. And like, you know, you got to be more blunt, you know? So it was like a very different writing style, which again, I think it was like a fun challenge, but like very different than the way either of us had written before. The other thing, and I think anyone who's been in an academic institution will hopefully appreciate this, lawyers, like, they're going to file this on our behalf. So they're also like fact-checking everything, right? You cannot say anything. We're used to citing, but we actually needed to produce for them every source that we use. So they, you know, they would like literally check the quote, right, against the original source. And when we first started talking about what would be procedurally the way, because they would have their paralegals check this. I'm in California, Jen's in New York, the lawyers are in a bunch of different places. Like, how do we do this? So they're like, well, we can have our like reference librarians contact your librarians. And Jen and I are like, our librarians at Rutgers and Berkeley respectively are going to be like, what are you talking about? Like, we've collected this material. We luckily had the assistance of some wonderful graduate students who helped us track things down. But basically, we compiled our own archive, right? Put it in the cloud and sent it to them to be able and you know, to match every citation, every quote. So, you know, another thing where it's just like you're working across just different ways of doing things, but the rigor was really impressive. So like, you know, we brought the history, we drafted it, and then they were saying like, okay, now we need to shape it. And it's got to look like it's a genre. It needs to look like a certain type of writing, because this is, right, you have to present a legal question that we're then providing history to answer. So it's written in a way that I hadn't written before. But, you know, I think it's part of, again, for me, both the intellectual excitement, but also the fun of doing this kind of work is getting to try new things. You're reaching new audiences. And for us, it was just really important that whatever happened in the courts, and I think this is likely true of most historians who write for the courts, is at least get the history right. Like, we can't control the decisions. We obviously have our preferred outcomes, but if you're going to invoke history, at least do so accurately.
Can you walk us through the parts of the brief, including how you use history to address the particular case?
Absolutely. You know, what we had to do was present, first of all, what's our interest? We're historians, right? So two of us wrote it, but we wrote it again on behalf of then an organization, the OAH, which signed on to it, as well as leading scholars of the military, foreign relations, and national security. And we were making an argument that there's a long history, again, to discrimination in the US military. And over time, both discrimination and then followed by inclusion have been justified on grounds related to efficiency, effectiveness, cohesion, readiness. And we were doing this in part because the argument the Trump administration was making to retract the inclusion of transgender troops was saying they were going to get in the way of readiness, cohesion, effectiveness. So what we thought what our contribution could be would say, like, they're making this argument. This, by the way, follows a pattern of the way people have made arguments in order to exclude people from the US military. This is a familiar argument in many ways. And we can track this argument through multiple groups. But, you know, we looked at four groups: African-Americans, immigrants or people deemed foreign, people not born in the United States, women, and then gay and lesbian service members. So we're saying we can produce, we can show you how this pattern has worked. And a part of what we were doing was showing that this is a pattern. And so one of the things that, as it happens in US courts over about the past 40 years, is there's extensive deference to the military by judges. They say, like, well, if the military says this is necessary for national security or this is necessary for military effectiveness, like, who are we civilian judges to doubt what they say? So part of what we were doing is saying, in this case, actually, you should doubt what they say, because this is an argument that we've seen time and time again. And time and time again, it's used again, first to exclude and discriminate, and then once forced to integrate or include, whether by law, by deciding it was, you know, by necessity, or any other reason that the military has chosen to be inclusive in the past, they again use the same language, a sort of critical to mission readiness, justifies then the integration and inclusion. These groups become absolutely essential to American military prowess. So in this case, again, be critical, listeners and skeptics, when the military produces this argument, when the Trump administration produces this argument, because we as historians have seen this before. And then we lay out for each group what happened, how African-Americans, for example, were discriminated against, excluded from certain jobs, certain ranks, you know, and there were segregated units and whatnot. And then what happens when, by executive order, Truman desegregates the armed forces? How does the rhetoric change? We are mindful that, of course, action and rhetoric are not always the same, but because this was a rhetorical move by the Trump administration to exclude based on these categories of readiness, effectiveness, cohesion, you know, basically what we're doing is showing, is saying, hold up a second, you know, we've seen this before. So, you know, then we lay out and, you know, we're giving examples, we're showing in each case the language used to exclude, we're showing what's the turning point that leads to inclusion, and then showing again each time there's this then move to use the same criteria to say, actually, this group is, you know, 100% essential to what we do. So as judges, you hear this case and hear the arguments being made, keep in mind this pattern. And what's unusual in the case of transgender service members is that they had been included under Obama, and then that was being taken away. It's now, of course, under the Biden administration, been restored. So we've seen this back and forth. And again, if you even just look over the past few years in the case of transgender personnel, it's the same pattern, right? Like they're important, essential for mission readiness. They're going to get in the way of mission readiness. They're essential again. It's a rhetoric to be wary of. And we as historians can document this. And that's part of what we're saying. Like, you know, there were retired military officers giving their perspective, you know, psychologists giving their perspective. But what we as historians could provide was the evidence to show that this, in fact, is a pattern. And this language and the use of this rhetoric is a pattern. So be mindful as you hear arguments about it.
That must have been such a great experience. I mean, as historians, we're always saying that we need to think about the present historically. And to do that in that space must have been incredible.
It was pretty exhilarating. It was a lot of work, and it was a lot of work to kind of get it together quickly, to, again, get it all fact-checked, to get it kind of packaged in the right way. We had to reach out to the OAH. We reached out to these individual historians. Another part of the process that I think is really interesting from just a scholarly production perspective is that, you know, when we reached out to the individuals who signed on, we, of course, you know, offer, you know, we're like, we'll show you the draft. Like, we're not expecting you to sign on to something that you haven't read. Some people read it and said, yep, I sign on. Some people read it and were like, wait a second, you know, or I think you should cite this, or, you know, they push on very specific points. So it was also a kind of cool experience in the sense of, you know, over 6 to 7 weeks producing a document that then got kind of different types of peer review, the peer review that we might expect from other scholars, but also the push from lawyers to be like, you know, how do you make this as clear as possible? Historians, right, love to immerse in every little detail. And it's an interesting task to balance the love of the fine grained detail with also, right, how do you document that only 6,000 words? So how do you, you know, within this space, how do you keep someone's attention? How do you stay on point? So, you know, I think that was also exciting too, to be participating in something that felt like, you know, this matters for democracy, for citizenship today, but also just from a kind of intellectual and scholarly perspective, to get this quick feedback and incorporate it and rewrite. We rewrote it several times just to get it as sharp as possible. And you don't often get the chance. How do you make your point the best way you can with all this feedback? Or it takes like 3 years, right? We send something off to a journal. It's like over years you're getting feedback, but this was fast. And it felt, you know, really substantive and meaningful, but also a really cool opportunity to sharpen writing skills and figure out how to write for different audiences.
Like this amicus brief, I feel like your current research on hospitals also relates to several issues that we as a society are concerned with today. I mean, you mentioned how the project idea came out of the Hobby Lobby case. You're dealing with issues of healthcare and reproductive rights. With this work, do you see yourself also you know, having this public conversation or working in this public facing way?
Absolutely. Early on, when I had just drafted like a little piece of trying to look into the church amendment, which is named for Senator Frank Church, doesn't refer to a religious church, which is the first federal healthcare conscience clause from the early 1970s. You know, I'd written up a short piece and presented it at a workshop. So it was with scholars. But one thing that was really interesting was the convener of the workshop, who was a women's historian, said, she's like, you know, there were a lot of things that I was were sort of puzzled me about, like my childbirth experience in a hospital, actually in a different town, but it was a religious hospital. And she's like, and now I think I understand it better. And that was kind of that first moment of like, right, so I've taken this current event that's launched this project. But as I work through it, this is something that I think will be meaningful to a lot of people in direct and indirect ways. So some people have a stake in it, and it's definitely in part about reproductive health care. It's also about end of life care, which, you know, to the degree that there is some healthcare process that like truly has the potential to affect every single person, you know, end of life care is something that at some point, whether it's your own or a family member, is the sort of thing that we do have to think about and encounter. There's also parts about LGBT care, other kinds of healthcare, but what I realized was like, yeah, there's a piece of this project that can be meaningful for everyone, for like any reader, but also can bring readers in because it can tell them something about experiences they've had. It can help them make sense of things. Whether it was a good experience or a bad experience, this can tell them something. And so I think it's been for me a process of then I am at heart a historian. Again, I love the detective work. Like I've got this puzzle, and the puzzle for me in this case is twofold. One is, so how is it actually, if we're trying to understand how hospitals as institutions acquire conscience rights? Well, what I realized was that it hinges on the fact that government funds go to religious hospitals. So that's how I ended up back in the 19th century, because it posed this question of, well, how and why are religious hospitals getting government money? That seems, again, from a First Amendment perspective, kind of odd. Second, then, it raised questions about what actually is a religious hospital. How are hospitals seen? Are they, maybe they're religious, but they're public serving? Is that different than a school? Is that different than, you know, some other charitable organization? These institutions that are actually part of our regular lives, we all in some way depend on hospitals, even if it's just that knowing that in an emergency, if you're in an accident, an ambulance can come and take you to a hospital, or someone can drop you off at a hospital. What happens when you enter those doors? What care can you expect to receive? What, of course, concerns in the society in which we live in the United States with all sorts of challenging insurance issues, you know, what bills might you expect? Like, right, there's all sorts of dimensions to this, but hospitals play a really key role in people's lives, sometimes because they're sick and need them, sometimes because it's there, sometimes because they might need them. So in that sense, we also live in a society where you don't necessarily get to pick the hospital you go to. So what are you going to get? What's going to happen to you at a certain hospital? You know, those are big questions about medical care, about insurance, about medical ethics. It's also built on a history of how hospitals have functioned in the United States, where their money comes from, what an individual hospital gets to decide about its own policy, what is structured by US law or by insurance policies. So yeah, again, I feel like this is a project that obviously something I'm still working on, but that I very much hope will resonate. And there's obviously, I think, topics that probably are more or less likely to resonate, though I actually strongly believe like you can make anything interesting to a broader public. And the key there is how you write it. So for me, you know, a big part of the project, there's the research part of the project, and then there's the writing part of the project. And it's how do you tell this history, again, in a way that is that is generative and productive for scholars, but also meaningful and interesting to a public audience. And it's a lot of work to figure that out. There's no magic, I don't think, to it other than, you know, thinking about how do we tell stories? How do we make sure there's evidence? How do we make sure our analysis makes sense? So I guess I'm just emphasizing work over magic.
One of the things that you've been showing in your discussion of both projects is how historians have something to offer in public conversations. And so related to my last question around your current research, what do you think historians broadly have to offer public conversations about healthcare and medicine, which is, of course, is a particularly salient question as we're in the middle of a global pandemic?
Yeah, you know, early in the pandemic, I was right at like teaching World War I in a class on the social history of the military when the pandemic hit. And like, we're like literally doing like influenza in the World War I military, and then, you know, global pandemic, here we are. And I then, you know, I actually last fall taught a class called Acts of God, Disasters in the American State. And what was exciting about that was, again, like, yeah, we're in the midst of a global pandemic. It takes a certain kind of student, maybe a certain kind of professor, to both want to teach and learn about disasters in the middle of a massive disaster. But one of the things my students said to me in that class was, you know, we really want to better understand the present we're living through. The kind of key questions for historians are about continuity and change, right? Like, where are their turning points? Where do things resemble the past? What's different? Where are the contingencies? What are the moments that make a difference? And, you know, we got to influenza in the disasters class. And one of my students said to me afterwards, she's like, I'm so glad we've done this, because now every time my family and friends say this is unprecedented, I can say, no, it's not unprecedented. And here's how I know that. And like, that to me is part of what really historians can do, is there are some things that are new and different, but we can put them in context. We can say, sure, this particular pandemic, of course, is different than other ones, but here are ways in which there are similar trajectories, or we can see where key turning points were, sometimes external factors, sometimes decisions people made, right? Where are the moments of human agency, and what did people listen to or not? There's certainly been in the public sphere all sorts of pictures from 1918, 1919 flu, the picture with the cat in the mask with the family, because it's like, right, this whole question over masks, which we're still debating, was debated then. The debates were not the exact same, but some of the issues around like freedom versus health were quite comparable. So we can reason from past situations. And when we think about health and medicine, I think some of the key things are that there's often a sense in the public sphere of a sense of inevitability. And in part, when you're talking about like viruses or bacteria, as though like, right, it's these organisms that we don't control and they do their thing. Well, actually, if we think about the history of health, the history of public health, the history of medicine, we can see how people tried to address things, whether or not they had full information. We can think about what are the institutions and infrastructure that either accelerated anxieties, paranoias, concerns, or alleviated them. What are things that we've done in the past that have worked? And so it's not to say it's the same as the past, but that by seeing things not as unprecedented, but as building on a longer set of cycles or patterns, and thinking about how institutions have either redressed or exacerbated challenges, we can use that information to think about what are some of the things we need to be thinking about in the present. We'll need to rely on different kinds of expertise in the moment to address our current challenges, but we can use our understanding of the past to think about what are some of the core questions we need to address. And, you know, when we're trying to understand, like, for example, like how to mask mandates, vaccine mandates, why is it that in the US, the debates take on a different tenor than they do in other parts of the world? Well, there's a long history of how Americans have thought about ideas about not just freedom and liberty, but health policy. How has health policy often been disguised through other mechanisms? All these kinds of questions that we can start to ask. And as we develop better answers to them, I think it helps us have a more clear sense of the present. But especially, I want to reiterate what questions to ask, because I think sometimes it's more about asking the right questions than having the kind of perfect answer.
Do you have any words of advice for historians who want to get into these public spaces that you've been talking about?
I think I'd give a couple of pieces of advice. One is to be attentive to what are the resonances of your work. And again, whether you work on, you know, ancient Rome or Asia in the 8th century or the US in the early 20th century, there can be resonances. Sometimes it's specific. You know, if people are trying to understand what's happening between Russia and the Ukraine right now, obviously it should be experts in Russia and the Ukraine who are thinking about that. And they can tell us, you know, where are some of the tensions emerging from. And the same thing, right? It's historians of medicine who can help us think through past pandemics. So I hope that for everyone, there's some resonance. And it's not about there's always a direct line. But there can be a connection. And what can you use that connection to help people in the present think about or think differently about our current moment? And then the second thing I'll say is that a lot of this has to do then with the ability to address a broader audience. So if you want to reach a public audience, whether it's in writing or on a podcast or in video or, you know, all different, there are all kinds of media people can be using today. I think one of the biggest challenges sometimes is, you know, we have to be able to write in different registers. We write in different ways for different audiences, and that holds for speaking and, you know, other modes of communication as well. So really thinking about your audience, what's your hook? What's going to be interesting or exciting? Where do you need context, and where does it, you know, where does too much potentially get in the way? Like, you know, people don't necessarily need to do every detail of whatever past moment you're thinking about. And especially in a lot of forms we have, maybe you're writing a whole book, but maybe you're writing 1200 words, you know, maybe you're doing a long podcast, maybe you get 2 minutes on the radio or something. How do you make the connection in the form you have? I think we can do this with total fidelity to the historical record and the sources we have, because ultimately as historians, we need archives, we need evidence, we need sources. We're not just pulling this out, but we get to be select the sources. Like, you pick the story that really captures the point you want to make, and you might have to leave 7 other stories in the cloud on your computer files. You can't tell them all. So you're going to pick the one that really works. One thing that historians are perhaps a little too well known for are really complex winding sentences. How do you tell a good story? It's probably not with like a 500 word sentence. You know, you're going to think about who are the best storytellers, you know, what do they do? Emulate them. The best way to figure out how to address a public is to see who's doing it well. And honestly, copy them, emulate them, see, you know, really like reverse engineer what they've done, and think about how you can do that with your knowledge base, your expertise, your connection to current events.
I really like how you use the word resonance as a way to understand how a historian's work can inform the present. And I feel like that resonance idea is also, you can also apply to audience based on what you just said about, you know, what storytellers resonate with the public and why. Thank you so much for talking with me today. It was a great conversation. I really loved hearing about your work and also about how you've connected your work on the past to the present. Before we go, though, can you let our audience know where they can find more about you and read your work and learn more?
Absolutely. I do have a website, ronitstahl.com, that I won't pretend I update all the time, but it does have a lot of links to my public work. My book, Enlisting Faith, is available at pretty much anywhere you can buy a book. And what I mean by that is, even if it's not at your local bookstore, they'll order it for you. My mom, who's my best PR person, got her hairdresser to order my book. So I promise you can order it anywhere. It's Enlisting Faith. I teach at the University of California, Berkeley. So if you happen to be in the area, you're also welcome to audit any of my classes. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
It was so great talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Public Historians at Work. You can show your support for this podcast and the Center for Public History through a donation at giving.uh.edu/publichistory.
For more information about the diverse work of the Center for Public History, find us online at uh.edu/class/cph or on Facebook and Twitter at UHCP History. Remember, we are all keepers of our history.